This is Radio Influence.
He got him in the white trunks. He hurt him.
That's beautiful. Oh, God. That's beautiful. He's got it.
And he forced the top. Wow.
And here's the submission. And it's all over. It's nice. All over. First round knockout.
Big
he's out. Rich
one
Franklin retains his belt.
The one thing that I never thought in a million years would happen, happened.
The champion. The challenger. Here we go.
This is the MMA Report with Jason Floyd on Radio Influence.
Welcome to the MMA Report podcast right here on Radio Influence. Coming up on this week's podcast, I'll be joined shortly by Daniel Galvan to recap the craziness of last weekend's Bellator 187 and UFC Fight Night 120. Plus, I will have fighter interviews with Frank Camacho, Zach Otto, John Salter, and Robert Watley. Now, before I bring in Daniel, I want to tell you about Fight TV. I've been telling you about Fight for the past year, and they are your number one source for MMA boxing and pro wrestling video. You can download the Fight app by going to Fight, FITE.TV/radioinfluence/. Of course, once again, that is Fight, FITE.TV/radioinfluence/. And coming up this weekend on Fight, you can watch ACB 74 for free on Saturday at 12 p.m. Eastern Time, which will feature Adam Townsend in the main event of the fight card. Daniel, as always, man, appreciate you coming on here at the start of the show to recap what happened last weekend, which it was a chaos. I think chaos might have been a word you actually used on the preview podcast that we did last Friday. The craziness of everything that happened last weekend, where, you know, really we should be talking about the unbelievable performance of Dustin Poirier and how he lifted himself into, taking that next step in his career in the UFC lightweight division. But let's be honest about it. Conor McGregor is the biggest story out there.
Yeah, man, it's really sad because that UFC Fight Night card was amazing. We expected it to be great. And honestly, some of the fights that I wasn't super looking forward to, I thought were pretty dang entertaining. It was a great card. We'll dig into that. But I did not anticipate us talking about Bellator 187. No disrespect to Paul Redmond and Kevin Ferguson Jr., but the card wasn't super stacked in Dublin. And here we are. And it was one of those situations where people were talking about Bellator during the middle of the day before it aired, and I was like, well, if people are talking about Bellator, that means something insane happened. And lo and behold, here comes Conor McGregor, the UFC's number one asset, giving Bellator a little bit of pub, a little bit of publicity. It was a big win for Bellator and a big loss for just about everyone else involved because Conor McGregor, well, he acted like a guy who understands how much leverage he has and how unaccountable he kind of is, right? Because he's honestly one of the few fighters that can do something like that and not receive significant punishment. Obviously, somewhere Jason High has a tear on his left eye.
And when I saw people kind of bringing up the Jason High situation, I'm like, come on. If you truly think the UFC is going to cut Conor McGregor, seriously, you can't pass USADA drug test, clearly, because you're not releasing Conor McGregor, because Scott Coker would be like, here's a blank check, Conor. Just write how much money you want. We'll get it clear. We'll make sure you're good. But, of course, we're recording this show here on Tuesday. Of course, show comes out on Wednesday every week on Radio Influence. And a true story is right before myself and Daniel started recording this aspect of the podcast, Conor McGregor did release a statement where he said, quote, I sincerely apologize for my behavior at last weekend's fight event in Dublin. While trying to support a loyal teammate and friend, I let my emotions get the best of me and acted out of line. As a multiple weight UFC champion, executive producer, role model, and public figure, I must hold myself to a higher standard. The referee, Mark Goddard, was making a horrendous decision in trying to pick up an unconscious fighter up off the floor and force the fight to continue into the second round. Even against the wishes of the said fighter's coach, the fight was over. After witnessing my fighter in a fight where the worst happened and the opponent passed away from his injuries on that night, I thought the worst was about to happen again. And I lost it, and I overreacted. I am sorry to everyone. I sincerely apologize to the director of the Mohegan Tribe Department of Athletic Regulations, Mike Mazzulli, all the officials and staff working the event, Andy Ryan, and his fighter, John, two staunch ones that put up a great fight every time. That side will always have my respect. And lastly, every one of my fans, I loves you all. I've always learned from my mistakes, and this will be no different. That was the statement released by Conor McGregor on Tuesday. My first thought of it was really in the first paragraph, how they made sure not even to mention Bellator's name. I'm sure that was done on purpose. I mean, and let's be honest about it. You know, I'm sure Conor McGregor had some say in this statement, but let's be honest about it. We know it was his management team who ultimately is the one who most likely wrote this statement. And look, he had to come out and apologize. But I do think if you are the UFC and looking back at this situation and realizing that, you know, you only have two active fighters that are pay-per-view draws, one being Conor McGregor and the other being George St. Pierre, you have to wonder about, is Conor a guy who just feels like no one can tell him what to do? He runs everything, and is he just out of control?
Well, he's certainly out of control, and you can even read into that in the apology. I mean, it starts off good. He's sincerely apologizing, which sincerely, like everyone is always sincere about their apology. I wish somebody would change it up and be like, I disingenuously apologize. I don't truly mean it. I'm being sarcastic. But it starts off strong. That was probably the stuff that was workshopped in Conor McGregor Inc. Incorporated. And then you can tell the part where he had influence, where he kind of buries Mark Goddard 6 feet under. And that is like the issue with Conor, point blank. He has an apology, and in the middle of his apology, he uses his absurd logic to justify his actions. It's like what he did there, he was not in somebody's corner, right? He was a fan.
Yeah, he was a fan. He was. I talked to – it was – and this is a true story. I was actually texting Mike Mazzulli about something and, you know, asking him about something before this event started. And, of course, I kind of felt bad for Mike because his phone was clearly getting blown up, you know, all Friday afternoon here in the United States. And that was one of my first questions I asked him. I said, was Conor McGregor a licensed corner man? And he told me no. And so, you know, at that point, as the whole thing unfolded and, you know, I'm sitting here kind of thinking about it, I'm like, I don't know legally if Mike can really sanction him. But I think if you're Conor McGregor, you should be thanking Mike Johnson of Bellator for not maybe trying to get him arrested.
Yeah, bro, look, if Bellator UFC comes down to my area, comes down to the State Farm Arena, Jason, I buy myself a ticket, and at the end of one fight after one guy's been knocked out, I come up and I push around a Bellator employee, and then I jump in the cage, and then I knock down the already knocked out fighter. I think I'm going to spend the rest of the night in some type of jail, okay? As simply put, I feel like some crime was committed during that instance. Bellator should come out strong. They should be like, we are officially suspending Conor McGregor indefinitely, so they can look cool. They should say that. But when you talk about like, gosh, I really wish I was famous so I could commit crimes and not really feel repercussions. And again, let's not bury the fact that he's such a Bush League move by him to continue to throw Mark Goddard under the bus. Like, Mark Goddard's just doing his job. And when you have a guy with so much power as Conor McGregor, I mean, this dude is straight up bullying others. Like, that is absolutely utilizing your power, your leverage, your fame to kind of almost slander someone else. Like, you, like, literally, when you think about all of the power Conor has, like all the crazy fanatics that will do anything he tells them to jump, they'll jump. He tells them to drink multiple pints of alcohol or eat several buffalo wings, they'll do it no matter the spice. And for him to kind of slander one individual, a guy who works in the sport, let's not, you know, make light of that. Like, that is serious. Like, that is actually, to me, the worst part. Aside, well, I guess the worst part is making contact with the fighter who was just concussed. That actually is the worst part, and that actually could be a crime.
Yeah, you know, one of the things of in the past, anytime you say something about Conor McGregor in not a positive light, a lot of fans like to come at you as a reporter and attack you. But this is one of those situations I think even Conor fans knew that they couldn't defend the guy. In terms of it, you know, in the second paragraph of his statement, he talked about basically saying Goddard was going to let this fight continue on to the second round. I did not, you know, watching the fight and how everything played out, I did not see that. You know, and Mike Johnson, who I mentioned, he's actually a part of Bellator's fighter relations department. You'll see him in the cage after every fight. And, you know, Conor did smack him. And so, you know, he should be very thankful, you know, that, you know, no charges did come from that, which to me, it was still kind of, in a way, kind of odd. And I get why Bellator was, you know, hey, tune in tonight to kind of see how this all goes down, which in reality, they really didn't offer any new footage. Everything that kind of happened was already online, which once again is why the hell are you tape delaying sports events in 2017? Could you imagine how many people would turn on Spike at, you know, 1 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday when all that craziness was going down?
Dude, exactly. We've been beating it like a dead horse. Sports is meant to be captured live. The reason being is sports offers the unpredictable nature of literally anything and everything happening. What would the odds have been for Conor McGregor becoming the main story for a Bellator card in 2017? The odds would have been astronomical and insane. And because they weren't on live TV, they didn't get that pop. Everyone would have turned on Spike TV. I mean, it would have taken them a while to figure out what channel it was on. But eventually, once they found it, they would have. And it'd be like, damn, Cops is on. But still, it's kind of like, duh. I mean, this is the price you pay for not living by kind of the creed we know. And the creed we know at this point is sports should be live. Because the great value in sports being live is the unpredictable nature of the content. And it was one of those things where not doing due diligence, not kind of following one of the principles we've learned, kind of came back to bite Bellator. Have the ratings come in for the card?
Yeah, the ratings did come out on Monday. They were actually higher than they were for the last Bellator event, which was a live event, which came in, I want to say, 508,000. The Bellator 187 card came in at 575,000. You know, the Conor aspect, that was actually in the very first fight that was on the main card. I will say, you know, look, you know, I was sitting on my couch on Friday night and it's 9 o'clock and I said, you know what, let me turn on Spike. I mean, I already had it set up to tape for a DVR and, you know, I watched it, you know, because, you know, there was part of me that was definitely interested to see how Bellator would cover it because obviously you had multiple hours to kind of put this package together and get it. And, you know, everything that was on the broadcast, we had already seen before. But, you know, I think look, if you're the UFC, there's got to be some concern here with Conor. We saw what happened in Poland with Goddard and the, you know, the Artem Lobov fight and Conor McGregor, who was not a licensed cornerman, was just nothing more than a fan here. And I think there's got to be concerns if you're the UFC. You do an international event, which, you know, Mark Goddard is going to be a referee they're going to use. And you do wonder, you know, could this keep bowling over and bring something else out? You know, and I think the other part of it's got to be is, you know, if you're a regional promoter over in Europe and you bring in an SBG guy and, you know, Mark Goddard's working your event, I think there's got to be some concern there. And it's just, you got to look at Conor McGregor. I mean, look, pushing a referee, it's not a good look. End of the day, it's not a good look. You know, I know Mike Mazzulli, you know, came out on the MMA Hour and noted that the UFC had told him that Conor would not headline the December 30th card. I truly do not believe the UFC would punish Conor McGregor by not putting him on the December 30th card. My guess is they probably don't have a contract with Conor done yet. And it's going to be interesting because UFC 219 on December 30th, tickets go on sale this week, Daniel. No main event, no co-main event now. So you got to imagine that something's going to happen this week. My gut feeling on it, I think Stipe Miocic is going to be the main event of that fight card. Against
you
who?
Think so?
Against who? No clue.
I mean, I think we could see a Stipe Miocic. Let's see. I think, I don't know, man. I think it could be a fight against, I guess, you see what Bellator's doing. Maybe Shogun Hua? maybe that's what you do. You find a light heavyweight that's kind of past his prime and match him up in a heavyweight championship fight, kind of do the Bellator Grand Prix.
How many options do you have? When you think about a main event, I mean, you know, look and tell me who your options are. If you don't go Stipe, because, you know, I think in an ideal scenario, you want to have Stipe defend the title against the winner of Ngannou and Overeem, which is coming up here. I mean, there's not many other options. I mean, you look at other options of who could headline 219. Maybe, you know, Woodley's got that injury, but he's kind of hinted that maybe he would come out. You know, him and Colby Covington, I think from a marketing aspect, that would be a fight to make there. But when you look at other champions, there's not really options for the UFC. I know they wanted to do Amanda Nunes versus Raquel Pennington. Obviously, that's no longer taking place with Pennington on the sideline due to injury. I just, not a lot of options there for the UFC.
Well, the thing is, like, okay, if you're looking at Ngannou Overeem, that fight happens December 2nd. I know we're getting Bisping coming back and fighting Kelvin Gastelum, like, super soon, but that was a super shocking story. I would imagine at heavyweight, you probably can't do a Stipe fight, dude. Like, I don't know who you wouldn't. To me, it's Overeem Francis winner. And again, first off, tickets go on sale. You want to get your main event out there. Mm-hmm. I think you are looking at a fight with at Walter White.
Or do you go, you know, if Verdum wins on Saturday night, you just say, hey, we're doing, you know, Verdum's going to turn. I mean, I'll tell you the Bisping thing. I feel so uncomfortable about that.
Yeah.
The guy got choked out cold after being dropped, and from a human aspect of this, I just feel just uncomfortable about him fighting 3 weeks after losing to GSP and what happened in that fight. And then also I'm like, if you're Michael Bisping, what is, like, he has nothing to win in that fight.
Yeah, well, the only thing for Bisping is he's so old that at 39 that he just needs to get back on track as soon as possible. That's the value for him. He's facing a heavy hitter. You get knocked out, you get suspended for 90 days, right? 60 days.
He got a 30-day suspension.
Oh, but if you get knocked out, what's the custom? 45 days.
Yeah, typically at least 45 days.
Yeah. So I mean, he didn't get knocked out. But I would assume, dude, based on the damage he took, the damage to his brain was similar to that of getting knocked out. Pretty close.
So
that's a tough matchup. I everyone should feel bad about it. We're saying it now, and we'll probably say it the day of the fight. And we should, because it makes no sense. It makes you wonder why they didn't go with a different fighter. I mean, the one I was looking at was Paulo Costa, but I guess he doesn't really have a whole lot of name value. And Bisping does, so that's why you go with Michael.
Well, and I think the other problem with that, where your options are limited, is how many guys could you get a visa to get, you know, to work in China on 3 weeks' notice?
That's true. You need to send all that stuff in such long events. We're just going to see Yushin Okami headline every event in Asia because the fight gets pulled 2 weeks before, and he's just fighting because you need to be. I think you need to be at least within the continent, maybe within the country, probably within the country.
I'll tell you a funny story about when all that came down with Anderson Silva. If people have not heard, Anderson is facing a potential USADA violation due to out of competition test. That is why Michael Bisping now is taking on Kelvin Gastelum. I interviewed Zach Otto, who people are going to hear later on in the show, and I asked him, and he's actually in the co-main event of this fight card, taking on Jia Ling, and I was, you know, one of the things of I was thinking about asking him was, hey man, you know, you've been around the sport for a long time, what's your thoughts of being on the same card as Anderson Silva? Glad I didn't ask that question, because I think it was literally about 10 minutes after I hung up the phone from Zach was when this news did come out here. Of course, that's next weekend, that fight card here in the States, main card, 7 a.m. Eastern time, 4 a.m. Pacific time for your four fight main card. If you want to watch the 8 fight prelims, Daniel, 3:45 a.m. Eastern time.
Jesus.
So 2:45 you're there in Texas for you. I gotta imagine. I mean, I can't imagine a lot of people getting up that early or staying up to watch that fight card. But
Jason, I got to ask you though. Just to circle back real quick for the December 30th card. What are your thoughts on the possibility of Ferguson Nurmagomedov on that card?
I mean, I think people would be all down for it, but Nurmagomedov's taking on Barboza on that fight card. That's a fight that
he's taking on Barboza.
Yeah. They announced that. What was that? 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago.
Jesus, that's I guess then you're looking at that's a weird situation because you got Gaethje Alvarez, and let's say Gaethje beats Alvarez. I mean, that's a fighter you would want against Ferguson. That does not make much sense to me to do Barboza and Nurmagomedov.
Yeah, when you look at the current UFC 219 fight card, of course, we've got Jimmy Rivera, we're going to talk about here momentarily, as Dominic Cruz is out of that fight. You have Cynthia Calvillo versus Jessica Sparza, Carlos Condit returning, taking on Neil Magny, Nurmagomedov, Barboza. You also have Usman against Meek. I mean, right now, when you look at the fights that are on that fight card, I mean, you would probably, if you input a title fight on that card, you got a headline Nurmagomedov and Barboza.
Dude,
and,
but that's a weak pay-per-view fight.
No. Look, that is a good co-main event of a pay-per-view. Headlining it, man, but if you're Tony Ferguson, I mean, from the business side of Tony Ferguson, why take the Khabib fight?
Well, you would take the fight, so it would just be the percentage of you're the only fight on this card, so I would assume you get a pretty big percentage.
Yeah, but the problem is if you take the Khabib fight and lose, now you've lost out on the ultimate payday with Conor McGregor.
Yeah, I know, but he may never get that opportunity. You know, you're just constantly looking towards the future for this hypothetical fight with Conor. I mean, Conor's going to be fighting twice a year, and it's one of those situations where you got to make your case for Conor. You got to demand that fight. Conor McGregor doesn't have Tony Ferguson like on his radar. He does to an extent. He obviously has been setting that fight up slightly, but for Conor, the next fight is always going to be the biggest money fight. It's always who presents the biggest money. And unless Tony Ferguson just pieces together dramatic wins and continues to build his brand, he will never be the answer to the question, Conor, which fight would make you the most money?
Well, I mean, the other side with Conor is, does he trust Khabib to show up on fight night?
Yeah. I mean, Khabib is very much like someone, the same way maybe Demetrius Johnson has questions about doing super fights or doing flyweight fights with bantamweight contenders making weight. You always have to have that question about, if it's a championship fight, you do that preparation going up against a fighter in Nurmagomedov who's had so many instances of not making it. I just really hope Khabib shows up at UFC 219 and kind of returns to a consistent schedule because I really love his attitude to go along with this talent. And he's a guy who may not be a superstar, a lightweight, but he provides a lot of depth in terms of his personality and the outrageous confidence he has.
Yeah, it would be, I hope one day we see Khabib and Conor just because I think it'd just be an interesting stylistic fight, but 50% chance that fight ever happens?
I would go less, man. I would go less just because I don't know how Khabib's going to be having long-term success against guys at lightweight at the very top. I think that Barboza fight's a nice one for him. Pretty clear how he can get his victory there.
I think the question I'm always going to have with Khabib, I mean, look, his wrestling's unbelievable. Everyone knows it. But what happens if he can't get the fight to the ground?
I mean, he'll lose fights against better strikers.
I mean, look, Michael Johnson was lighting him up on the feet last year until Khabib got the fight to the ground, and then it was a one-sided fight. But I love that Khabib Barboza fight. I mean, that's a Fox headliner. That's not a pay-per-view headliner.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, that would be a very poor buy rate. They got to figure something out. So they got to figure it out quick. That December 30th day is getting quicker and quicker.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally 45 days away,
Yeah, I mean, especially when, people are maybe considering going out to Vegas for New Year's Eve, you want to put that out there. But let's talk about UFC Fight Night 120. It's taking us 20 minutes to get to here, but let's talk about it. Dustin Poirier, it was a night of, craziness, some, things that we just did not see happening. We had a fighter apparently wearing a UFC version of a diaper.
I love that Paul Felder mentioned that. Junior Albini, what are you doing?
Like, who, like, is there not someone in Junior's corner that is like, hey, dude, you need to fix your trunks here because it looks like you're wearing a diaper?
Dude, it looked like, I mean, I don't understand how anyone at Reebok, I'm pretty sure there's not like some magical Reebok guy making sure everyone looks interesting beforehand, but Albini, man, he looked like he's rocking some Depends, but at least he looked like he was packing.
Yeah, I mean, it just, man, just, I mean, where is the person in your corner saying, God, we got to change it up? I mean, then we have Clay Guida scores his first TKO win. You know, I think it was a 2009 or whatever it was. I put it up there on social media. You know, Fajeya Marquardt was, you know, not really a great fight. Matt Brown, Jesus Christ, what an elbow. Of course, I mean, look, we're both in the technical side of broadcasting. Look, glitches happen. You know, you can't always guarantee you're going to have a perfect product. It's unfortunate that the glitch happens right as Matt Brown is knocking out Diego Sanchez. But, man, I mean, I was watching the fight with some buddies and, you know, Dustin Poirier. I mean, there was – I don't know if there was really ever a moment in that fight that I was like, Pettis is going to turn this thing around.
Yeah, so the deal with the Poirier-Pettis fight is unfortunately had the anticlimactic ending. But having watched the entire fight, this was a big time, like, step into the spotlight moment for Dustin Poirier. And it was all about him dictating this entire fight, which is not something I anticipated. I mean, Pettis did enough to make this really fun and really interesting. But the entire bout, Dustin Poirier, to me, this was a bit of a showcase for his talent level against a premier lightweight. And it's unfortunate that he wasn't able to kind of piece together that highlight reel knockout that would have, like, been just picture perfect idea of the superstar making performance. He didn't get that, but I thought he cut a great promo afterwards. And most importantly, technically, he was so superior to Anthony Pettis, which is just not something I anticipated. Again, obviously for Anthony, it's been a bit of a downswing for him, but he still showcased quite a bit of skills. Moral of the story is I thought this fight was entirely about Dustin Poirier kind of asserting himself among the elite fighters at lightweight, the very elite. And I love that he demanded a fight against the winner of Alvarez and Gaethje.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great post-fight interview for him. And, you know, look, that's just a fight that absolutely makes a ton of sense for Dustin Poirier. I would say the only kind of weird moment of that fight was when the referee had called to stop the action because he wanted the doctor to look at that cut. And like literally about a second before, you know, right a second after he called for it, it looked like Pettis was going to, you know, attempt to get another choke there on the ground, you know, which, you know, was kind of, but I don't think because of the amount of blood that was kind of going on and how slippery the guys were, that it was ever really going to, you know, be something that was going to be in serious contention there. But a great win for Dustin Poirier, and look, loves it. And, you know, for Anthony Pettis, I just don't know where he goes from here.
I mean, for Anthony Pettis, if you're the UFC, this is a fighter with the name, and that's a lot of value for you. That's a fighter you can put in main event, co-main event slots on TV and feel confident about it. Not from Anthony's perspective, but just from the UFC's perspective, he represents a name gatekeeper. From Anthony's perspective, I don't really know where you go from here. Because obviously for each fighter, the goal is to become champion one day or be a top fighter. And looking and thinking about how Anthony Pettis would match up against Poirier or Gaethje or Alvarez or Magomedov or Ferguson, I think he'd be a solid underdog moving forward after this performance.
Yeah, it's, you know, we talked about in the preview podcast, can he regain that magic? And I don't know. And I don't know what the answer is for him. You know, is it?
I mean, would you like to see him fight next?
You got to put him in a showcase fight. You got to put him up there against a guy that's going to strike with them, top 20-ish guy.
Maybe even a fighter who's not even ranked, basically.
Yeah. Someone who's not ranked. I mean, maybe it's a guy like a Joe Duffy.
Maybe it's a guy like Joe Lozon.
Yeah, man. I remember a couple of years ago hearing people kind of talk about, you know, after, you know, Joe had kind of been through some wars of maybe it was time for him to kind of hang it up because he does have, you know, he is very successful outside the cage. But when you look at Clay Guida, once again, he had a great post-fight interview, and it was his first TKO win since 2008, April 2nd, 2008. It was his first stoppage victory, as I scroll down here, to 2011 against Takanori Gomi.
Dude, I love this. This was for fighters. Every time we talk about guys who look like they're a bit old, should retire, maybe step away from the cage, I kind of had thoughts about that with Clay Guida not too long ago. You know, when he was suffering losses time and again, and some of his fights weren't the greatest. Gosh, he looks renewed, man. I mean, this fight was great. I thought if we were talking about a 67-second victory, well, we'd be praising Joe Lauzon. Incredibly tough scrapper. Obviously, a guy battle-tested. Potentially could be kind of chipping away at his ability to take punishment. But Clay Guida looked fantastic. You mentioned the post-fight promo. Great. Honestly, one of the highlights of the entire night. He was working the crowd almost like a WWE wrestler. In fact, better than most WWE wrestlers currently. I mean, it was great. And the UFC better give him a new contract is all I got to say. Because Clay Guida looks renewed. He looks re-energized. And it's kind of funny because you mentioned he finally got the TKO victory. And, you know, when he started off his run in the UFC, he came across as just, to me, his reputation was this guy is an all-action fighter, super aggressive, super fun to watch. And then it seemed like there was a middle point where he kind of dipped down to a more conservative style, more grappling style. And it appears as though he's kind of returning back to that previous iteration of himself where he is just a fighter where every time Clay Guida is on a fight card, you got to watch. So moving forward, Jason, I'm not super sure how high Clay Guida can climb up the ranks. I don't even think he will be able to climb up the ranks too far, but it's nice to see him back at lightweight. And again, I don't think it's time for either him or Joe Lauzon to retire, but needless to say, the Carpenter looked great.
Yeah, great great call for him there. Rafael Sunsao gets the knockout win over Matthew Lopez. Also at bantamweight, Marlon Moraes gets a split decision win over John Dotson. And, you know, both, you know, Marlon Moraes, I thought, you know, look, a good post-fight interview. But in terms of if either one of those guys is fighting Jimmy Rivera at UFC 219 or maybe later on, you know, with Jimmy Rivera needing a new opponent, to me, the edge has to go to Rafael Sunsao. Sorry, Marlon Moraes, but you look at the resume of Rafael Sunsao, it just makes more sense. If the UFC's mindset is Jimmy Rivera versus whoever is a number one contenders fight, to me, it makes much more sense for it to be Rafael Sunsao over Marlon Moraes, and we all know Sunsao has a win over Moraes.
And we all know he has a history with TJ Dillashaw, 1-1. So you're right. I think what we saw on Saturday night was, to me, the Marlon Moraes fight was more impressive just because of what he did against John Dotson, right? Winning a fight like that against Dotson is much, much more impressive than kind of picking apart Matthew Lopez and finishing him. That's just more of kind of the quality of opponents. I would just rate Dotson so much higher than Matthew Lopez. But given the track records, given Marlon has lost to Sunsao and also is, you know, 1-1 in the UFC, contrasted with, you know, for a fact that you can go to the bank and put the Sunsao Rivera winner against your champion, without question, Rafael Sunsao is the move to make. And I thought both guys looked good. Marlon Moraes surprised me. I mean, you picked him headed into it, and you were right, man. To me, I guess UFC jitters was the issue for him previously because in this one he looked very comfortable. Don't really understand some of the scorecards, especially 30-27 for Dotson. In fact, I was like 29-28, but for Moraes. But I thought Marlon Moraes looked good. But you're right in terms of moving forward, who could step in on December 30th? Rafael Sunsao is clearly the answer.
And we got this comment from Brian Abraham on Twitter saying, what can Rafael do to get a title shot? In my opinion, go heel and stop being so nice. Brian, I would say this. I don't know if that's in the personality of Rafael Sunsao.
Nope. I mean, we've seen Rafael Sunsao fight time and again over years. And we know the identity of fighters like that. They hardly shipped. I mean, there are very few instances I can ever think of a fighter whose personality type has changed over the course of their career that dramatically. So I don't think we're going to have Rafael Sunsao come out in Norfolk, Virginia and call people dirty animals like Colby Covington. I think he's completely content with just fighting, being respectful. But Jesus, you know who cut the best promo was Cesar Ferreira. I want to see him and Paulo Costa fight. What did Paulo Costa do to his house? What did he do? It's insane, man. That I can't wait for that fight. That fight better happen.
And I'll tell you, I think I've written off Nate Marquardt over the years, and you know he's still, you know, look, he can still be a very competitive guy, but you know, for Diego Sanchez, I have to wonder, is there an exit strategy for him? And I don't think there is.
He's in the, like, you know, when you deal with old people and you got to take away their keys from the car, like that's the issue.
I mean, like that fight looked like two guys in two totally different weight classes.
It was a great fight, by the way. Like the thing is, Sanchez was a couple punches or a couple hard liver kicks away from getting the win, though.
I mean, it's just he had that one good shot, but he didn't take advantage of it. And I just, you know, I look at this, and we'll see whether it's Matt Brown's final fight. By no stretch of the imagination, do I think Diego Sanchez is retiring. I don't see that happening at all.
It's not in his makeup, but you know what sucks is, obviously he's been a part of so many wars, man, but having lost three of his last four, it's very similar to what we're seeing out of Gomi, where three of his last losses are all first-round KO losses. And that's just dangerous stuff. That's just dangerous stuff. And I love Diego Sanchez, legitimately a legend in the sport and a foundational piece for the UFC, actually. They built upon him. But this is just dangerous. And, you know, it seems like there are people around Matt Brown's camp that want him to continue fighting, which is fine by me. He looks great here. But for Diego Sanchez, people need to get in the way of him in the octagon.
Yeah, it makes you wonder more. Is that maybe a family around Matt? Maybe they want to see him retire, you know, and that could definitely be part of it. Arlovski gets a win. We mentioned about that. The second and third round, I was like, Junior, what are you doing?
Yeah, he let Arlovski win that fight. It was the pace from Andre Jr. This was a bad performance out of Albini. I mean, this was a perfect setup for him, and he didn't really challenge Andre too terribly much. Andre's action and aggressive and speed, really. Speed was the killer, and the this was a fight Junior gave away. All-around bad night for Junior Albini. He came out like a damn 85-year-old that escaped the nursing home. And ended it with a loss, and it just don't really know what his strategy was.
Yeah, just a very weird strategy there.
Jason, do you want to apologize?
I was going to bring up that fight next.
Do you want to apologize?
I'm not apologizing.
You hater?
For picking against Sage Northcutt, but hey, man, give Sage credit, man. You know, and you know, moves a team alpha male, and congratulations, a nice win for him.
Whatever, Sage was the kind of guy that would bully me in high school, so I'm not going to apologize, but no, he looked good. He looked really good against Michael Quinones. You know who I thought was kind of the star of the prelims was Tatiana Suarez, mm-hmm. Woman's strawweight. This is like phenomenal story. Great fighter, great wrestling base. Suarez, I think, is just obviously a name at strawweight to look out for.
Yeah, and so so that's UFC Fight Night 120, Bellator 187. AJ McKee gets a technical submission win in the third round against Brian Moore. Kevin Ferguson Jr. A win against Fred Freeman. So obviously those are really the two matchups to really pay attention to going into that crowd. I think Lee now is just, you know, AJ McKee, he's had 10 fights now. The time has come for him to fight elite competition in the Bellator featherweight division.
No, I think you should give him some more 2-2 guys. No, yeah, you're right. This guy needs the Ed Ruth treatment. I mean, look, AJ McKee, he's been fighting probably since before he was born. And this card sucked. This card sucked. You look moving forward, the next card kind of sucks for Bellator. And, to me, the next time people are going to care about a Bellator card is likely, I don't know, Michael Page, Michael McDonald card in England in December, which isn't too far away, but there's quite a few cards in between.
Yeah, I mean, you look at coming up on Thursday, the and you're here from John Salter here later on the show, but this is another tape delay event. And I'll say this, you know, with Pitbull having to pull out due to an injury and that fight being off the fight card, Bellator, to me, from a location aspect, made it the smartest decision they could of making Nola Hot Jeremiah Libiano the main event of that fight, because they are playing to the Israel audience with the main event, co-main event. While I understand people in the States are going to be like, hey, why is that the main event and co-main event with Ghazali in the co-main event? That's all about keeping that crowd around. John Salter, you know, he gets a replacement opponent here in Jason Radcliffe. People hear from that. But, you know, also Jessica Middleton's on this card as well. But, you know, it's going to be a 24-hour-plus tape delay. And, you know, I'm sure people will watch on Friday night just because it'll be MMA on. But definitely not going to get, you know, I don't think I've really seen anyone really even mention the fight card this week on social media so far.
I mean, all we've been talking about Bellator has been Jack Swagger, right?
I tell you what, I like the signing. You know, this is not CM Punk, first off, because, you know, his real name, Jake, is he has a amateur wrestling background from his time, you know, wrestling at the University of Oklahoma, trains here in my hometown of Tampa, Florida. And, you know, to me, you know, I think there's two locations for Bellator that you take Jake to for his MMA debut. It's either Tampa, because A, he lives here, trains here, and there's a rich history of pro wrestling here, or you do an event at the University of Oklahoma.
Yep. Boomer Sooner. I think that's the strategy. Get old JR Jim Ross there. And I think obviously superior choice than CM Punk. CM Punk is a much bigger star, so that's what the value is there. But Swagger, given his history, the issue is obviously he's like, what, 13 to 12 years removed from that history in college at Oklahoma. But he had a lot of success there. This is a guy who showcased his fighting ability in the WWE, just a great world heavyweight champion, a lot of amazing fights with The Undertaker and Shawn Michaels and John Cena. And, you know, the WWE style is a bit different than mixed martial arts, Jason. But at the end of the day, both are real sports. So I think Jack Swagger is going to do real good.
I mean, but he is 35 years old, so it kind of makes you want it there. So,
what'd you do in terms of opponent? Just crappy opponents?
Oh, tomato cans.
Tomato cans.
I mean, you gotta build that sucker up there. But you know, I like that signing by Bellator. Also, Bellator on Tuesday announced that the main event will be Lorenz Larkin versus Fernando Gonzalez. That'll be January 26th in Temecula, California. So we'll see what happens there with that event coming up in January. But of course, on Saturday is UFC Fight Night 121. We'll have a preview podcast later on this week, headlined by Fabricio Werdum versus Marcin Tybura. Of course, supposed to be Mark Hunt. But now it's that's the other part that's really makes you wonder about the UFC. So Mark Hunt does this interview where he says the things he allegedly says, you know, even though apparently he says he's misquoted. So they pull him from that event, but we're cool with the guy fighting on short notice on 3 weeks after getting submitted.
It makes no sense, but obviously, you know, the relationship they have. I mean, that is a toasty, testy relationship. And yeah. I don't know if they're gonna if Mark Hunt is gonna send the UFC Christmas family card. Like I just don't think they have that type of relationship. But look, Jason, if there's one thing that we know as mixed martial arts observers, is that hypocrisy runs rampant.
Yeah, so you're saying Dana and Mark Hunt aren't having dinner together? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying they aren't having dinner together, and I'm also saying Conor McGregor is gonna get off scot free.
Yeah, but the rest of this fight card, matchups that I'm looking forward to, Tim Means, Bilal Muhammad, that should be a very exciting fight to watch there at 170 pounds. Lenson Brooks is on this fight card. Of course, that was supposed to take place back at UFC 216. Of course, that fight ultimately did not take place due to the weigh-in issues with Nick Lentz. You know, it's I guess the good thing for the UFC is there is no major college football this weekend. I don't know if you saw the television ratings for the Alabama game, 7 million. Notre Dame, Miami game had 6 million. So it was a tough weekend for the UFC to draw viewers. But this weekend in college football, there's literally no marketable matchups.
Really? That's sad. Yeah, man, this card kind of sucks too, but I mean, it makes sense why it sucks. It's in Australia, and so, you know, the UFC reminds me of, like, the way I would be in a relationship, like, 3 years in, where I just kind of give up and take things for granted. That's the same way the UFC treats international markets nowadays, you know? Talk to all the poor people in Canada, and, yeah, this card's okay. You mentioned the one fight I'm looking forward to, Meads and Muhammad. Also, you could talk me into Jake Matthews and Velikovic, and also I'm looking forward to watching Alexander Volkanovski return and take on Shane Young. I think Volkanovski has a lot of potential, obviously.
And, of course, speaking of UFC Fight Night 121, the opening matchup on the FS1 prelims will be a lightweight matchup between Damian Brown and Frank Camacho. I had a chance to catch up with Frank late last week to talk to him about this matchup. Of course, he's now returning to 155 pounds after taking a short notice fight in his UFC debut at 170 pounds. Also talked to him about his YouTube channel, which he's doing like a basically I would call it a mini documentary called The Crank Effect, which really just looks into his life inside and outside of fighting. So I had a great conversation with Frank. So you're going to hear from Frank now, and then when we come back, we'll start getting into some other things going on in MMA. Joining me now here on the MMA Report on Radio Influence, a man that fights this weekend, UFC Fight Night 121 down in Sydney, Australia. Frank Camacho takes on Damian Brown, returning to 155 pounds. Frank, I appreciate the time. I get that's the first thing. You haven't fought at 155 in a couple of years. Was it just a obviously you made your debut at 170, short notice fight, where you end up getting a fight night bonus. Was just one of those things after that fight, you and your team sat down and said, you know what, we need to be at 155. That is the appropriate weight class for you?
Yes, actually, we were on our way back from Singapore in Korea, the Korean airport, and I was talking to my coach, and I was like, man, you know, hey, you know, coach, man, I've just been BSing, you know, I could fight at welterweight. Yeah, I'll get away with fighting at welterweight. But man, you know, you have a guy like Leach who's a legit welterweight, you know, we really talked about like just being a NASCAR, you know, like, man, you got to take out the air conditioning. You got to take out the passenger seats. You know, you got to put on the big wheels. You got to put on the big engine, you know? So, all being said, 55 is definitely where I need to be. You know, especially for the level that I'm competing at in the UFC right now.
And anyone who goes to your YouTube channel, a little, I guess we call it a mini documentary that you put up there. There's six episodes, the Crank Effect. And part of it was about that UFC debut. And, you know, it's footage that, you know, we really never see, you know, you and your opponent after it. He's talking about how, you know, he broke his foot on you and you're showing him the damage that he did to your thigh, you know, and that's the kind of thing that, you know, I think really it shows who you are as a fighter. It's, you know, a lot of times we don't see that. So anyone out there, I highly recommend going and watching The Crank Effect. I believe it's in one of the episodes where your wife had said, you know who Frank is. So it's 15 minutes. You see him in the cage, but this is really about kind of showing, you know, the father, the husband and what it is of being there. Of course, I got to ask, what is the differences in living in Guam as opposed to Maryland?
You get 80 degree weather all year, the beach, the swimming blue water is, not more than 15 minutes away everywhere. and family and friends, man, Dan, this is home, you know, nothing like home, you know, someone from Maryland, you know, trying to move here, they could get culture shock. Like, dude, this is a small island. Like, how am I going to survive in such a small island, you know? And it's just, I see the same freaking people like every week, you know what I mean? So it is what it is, and it's home, you know. It's the islands are home for me, you know, Saipan and Guam, and it's I can't complain. I was gonna do this interview at the beach, man, but I seen you eat breakfast, and I was like, oh, okay, I'll go to the beach after this, so get some active recovery going.
You know, I think in Guam, I think my first introduction to MMA in Guam was Joe Taimingla, what he has been able to do in Bellator. Yeah, but you guys have built a little team over there. JJ Ambrose, who fights in Bellator. Yeah. You're in the UFC. You got a Ryzen fighter. So when people hear Guam MMA, what would you want them to think?
Man, I want them to think of tough island boys that just leave it out all on the cage all the time, you know? And you see, and it's so cool because I really admire, like, you know, even our neighboring island, well, 6 hours away, right? But our neighboring islands, like in Hawaii, you know, the Hawaiian guys, you know, they always bring it, you know, man. And then you have a champ, you know, and you had a former champ, you know, BJ Penn, and it's just, I don't know what it is, man. I don't know what it is, like, you know, but is that I just want people to know the fighting spirit that all these island boys would always bring.
And I mentioned about the crank effect. One of the things that it showed was, you know, you got that fight night bonus, $50,000. Obviously, you know, in that series you talk about, you know, hey, there were tough times where, you know, you're trying to figure out, you know, how are we going to, you know, make ends meet, but you get 50K, you got a chance to take your wife and child on a vacation. You know, is it, you know, when you have that moment where, you know, hey, you've been battling for 14 years to get to this moment. And I'm sure there's times where you're like, man, why am I doing this? Why am I putting my body and my family through it? Was there a moment maybe on that trip that maybe you realize, like, okay, this is why I've been putting myself through this for the last 14 years?
You know what it was? It wasn't more so that trip. It was right when we got on the bus after Singapore, heading back to the hotel. You know, I remember getting on the bus and I was so bummed. I was like, man, I lost this fight. I don't know what's next. You know, or you know, do you think they want me to fight again? You know, I was just going through all the emotions of going through a loss, and then I was watching the press conference on my phone. And then when I saw that okay, you know, I forgot what his name was, but he was going through it. It was like, oh yeah, Holly Holm, performance of the night, Sasaki, and then fight of the night goes to Leech and Camacho. You know, it really like hit me, and not so much about the 50K right off the bat, you know, but it was more so like, man, you know, I've been training and I've been fighting for 14 years, and I'm so glad that people appreciated it. You know, they appreciated what I put in, you know, and they appreciated the passion and the heart that I left all out there for the fans, and more so for myself, right, and for my family. And then I started tearing. I just remember talking to my coach and I started tearing. I was like, man, this is really, really cool, you know. And I was like, hey, man, we can do this. You know what I mean? So and I'm just so super stoked for the opportunity, you know, coming up, you know, this week.
And of course, you know, obviously I'm sure you were back in the gym the next week and dissecting what ultimately you did wrong. I know your coaches have talked about, you know, some things that you did wrong. One of your coaches, I know he talked about, he said, you know what? Maybe if he didn't make that mistake, maybe he wouldn't have got that $50,000 bonus, and maybe he would have got the win, but not the bonus. But, you know, as you have, you know, prepared for this fight, I mean, was it just, you know, those minor tweaks that you realized you needed to make?
You know, the 2 weeks or the week and a half, it just went by so fast, you know, and it was, I just remember getting on the plane and I was like, we're on our way to Singapore for the UFC, you know, like the whole week here, I was just getting ready for medicals, you know, just getting all the paperwork done. And then, yeah, it was, it happened so fast. And then when I got there, I started getting winded. So then I couldn't really think, you know, while I was in the cage and I was fighting, I was getting tired. So I was like, oh, okay, I don't know. And then I just, my coach was telling me after the fight, he's like, man, going into the third round, or he just spoke to my other coaches and my other corners, like, Frank's on autopilot. And then I just started, I don't know what I was doing in there. I was having too much fun.
But you got Damian Brown here. You got to go in his backyard. Is that a role you love playing, going into, you know, when you're, you know, going into your opponent's backyard? I mean, do you just kind of feel like, hey, man, I mean, I understand there's pressure in every fight. There's not such thing as no pressure. But don't you kind of feel like, man, he's the guy that he's got a little more pressure because he's fighting his home country?
Yeah, well, man, you know, I think everywhere I fight in the UFC is going to be, I'm going to be in someone's backyard, because I don't think they're going to have a UFC on Guam, you know, you know, population base, all of that, right? But there might be, you know, I think there's an equal amount of pressure on both ends. You know, we're both coming off losses. He's fighting and he has Australia all on his back, you know, and I'm the bad guy coming in trying to dethrone their dude, you know. But yeah, I know the pressure is on me because I know that I don't want to, not that I'm like shitting on the judges or anything, but I can't go to decision with this guy, you know. And not so much that I don't want the bad calls, but I just need to make a statement, you know, especially down at back at 55. And then Damian Brown, yeah, he's gonna come out and he's gonna perform, you know. But then stylistically, man, we're just bound to have a good fight.
when you're taking on somebody that is coming off a loss and you're preparing for that fight, I mean, clearly you're going to look at his film because you want to see what you can expect in the fight. Do you maybe go back to more of the fights that he won and maybe try to compare and contrast of why things went well on one night and didn't go well on the other night?
Can you say that one more time? Sorry, I missed that.
Do you do a little comparison and contrasting, you know, when you're preparing for a fighter, you know, you look at his wins and see what he did well in those fights, but then go his losses and maybe try to figure out, is there a common characteristic in why he couldn't get the win on that night?
Oh, yeah, of course, man. I've watched so much footage of him. It's like I already kind of feel like I've sparred of him, you know? Yeah, you know, and there's a couple things that Damian Brown brings that makes him very successful is that he's ultra durable. He lets it all go. He fights his heart out, and he comes with a big gas tank, you know. And it seems like the more you punch him or the more that you attack him, the more he will come back at you, you know. So I just gotta and for me and then I have to assess myself on my side, you know. Starting the camp, I know that against Leech I didn't check leg kicks, and then also too I've had when I fought Neil Magny in the Ultimate Fighter, and then when I fought the last fight against Leech, I have a very questionable gas tank, you know. So just all these things that I gotta assess and truly be honest with myself, you know what I mean. And so that's what we really worked on this fight camp.
Of course, this is here in the United States. It's a nighttime card, but in Australia, it's a morning card.
Yeah, yeah.
How is that a challenge of, you know, when you're fighting early in the morning to, you know, get loose and get your body going? And do you alter your training to, you know, prepare for, hey, I'm going to be fighting, you know, before noon?
Well, yeah, because I think I'm fighting at 11 a.m. Sydney time, which is 11 a.m. here on Guam anyway. I think we're in the same time zone, but it's not going to be a big difference. I mean, I have a morning session every day, like around 9:30, so my body's up and I'm ready to rock around that time anyway, you know. So it's not going to be an issue. I mean, if it was like 8 in the morning, then yeah, we might have to alter some stuff, you know. But I'm just so glad that we're fighting at 11 a.m. our time or Sydney time, so yeah, it's not gonna be too much of an issue,
you know. And I mentioned about JJ Ambrose, and he talked about it. He's like, look, he goes, how can you not root for Frank? He goes, I go on his social media, you know, he's doing what he can to give back to the community, because, you know, that's something we always don't necessarily hear about. So what are you doing to the community in Guam? And is it one of those things that you feel that, hey, I can use my notoriety, you know, as an athlete to kind of, you know, help things get better?
Yeah. You know, growing up, you know, especially in the small island, I never really had there was never really a professional athlete, you know, coming to the schools and talking to, and you know, so that's the whole premise of my whole show, you know. Like, I want to try to inspire these kids that, hey man, you know, because there's only a couple things that if you're from the islands, you're either gonna go to college and then come back home and then work a job, or you're gonna join the military, or you're gonna live off the government, you know. So I'm not saying those things are bad, they just weren't for me, you know. And I just wish that I had someone that came to me like, hey Frank, you know, if you want to be an athlete, you know, you know, you can go to this, you can go here, you know, there's a strength and conditioning program here, da da da, you know. Like, I never had anyone guiding me. So the whole premise of the show is to kind of inspire these people, like, hey man, if you want to be a pianist, dude, go do it, man. You know, just make sure you take the steps that you need to do, and you can do it, you know. So I just feel that I would be doing my island and my community a disservice if I didn't pay it full, you know, and I'm in a position where I can. So, I mean, I just got to give back any way I can, you know, and through martial arts, you know, there's women's self-defense, free women's self-defense seminars that I do. There's stranger danger stuff with the kids, you know, and just any way that I could make a positive impact and a positive difference in my community via martial arts, you know, because martial arts saved my life. And maybe someone out there can take from me, you know.
Final thing, I got to ask this. Does your wife come to your fights? Or is she one of the, she tries to stay away?
No. She goes to every fight. She goes to every fight. My mom has never seen me before, though.
Really? Now, is mom a supporter of you being a fighter, or is she kind of like in between?
Yeah, dude. It's so funny, dude, because she's the cutest thing ever, man. She's like a huge fan. You know, she's finally like seeing, and she's finally like WhatsApping. You know, she's finally on her phone. You know, and then she'll just like text her friends and everything like that. And I'm like, mom, you've never seen me fight before. Like I try to show her like a highlight reel. She's like, oh no, I can't watch it. It's so funny, man. It's so awesome. But yeah, my wife goes to every fight. She's gonna be there at the fight, and dude, she's my number one cheerleader. She's great.
And of course, everyone's going to be able to see your fight, of course, here Saturday night in the United States, Sunday morning in Sydney, Australia. Frank, I really appreciate time. Let everyone know they can follow you on social media, and let them know about your YouTube channel so they can check out that documentary on yourself.
Yeah, man, you know, just check me out on all social media platforms, on Twitter, on Instagram, at Frank the Crank, on Facebook, and then also to my Crank Effect Show on my YouTube channel. Just search Crank Effect Show, C-R-A-N-K. EFFECT. It's just kind of like a little part of my journey, and you get a little insight of who I am and the people around me. So it's really, really cool, man, and you guys check it out.
Great stuff there from Frank Camacho. Really appreciate him coming on the podcast, talk about his fight coming up on Saturday at UFC Fight Night 121. Of course, you can watch his fight a part of the FS1 prelims. He'll actually kick off the FS1 prelims on Saturday night, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time here in the United States. Now, coming up next week is going to be UFC Fight Night 122, UFC Shanghai, whatever you want to call it. But one of the men that's going to be a part of that four-fight main card, and right now on UFC.com, it's listed as he'll be in the co-main event, Zach Otto. I had a chance to catch up with him late last week to talk to him about being on his fight card. As I mentioned earlier on the podcast, when I had Daniel on, I was actually going to ask him about fighting on a fight card with Anderson Silva. Glad I didn't ask him that question, but I did talk to him about his fight coming up next weekend in China. UFC Fight Night 122 is going to be taking place on November the 25th. Of course, it's a fight card headlined by Anderson Silva and Kelvin Gastelum. We're now joined by one of the men that's going to be part of this fight card, Zach Otto. Zach, as always, man, I appreciate the time. What's been going on since that win in June?
Oh, just been training, running the gym. You know, I'm involved in other businesses as well, just outside of fighting, but they all kind of revolve around MMA. So we had another show. We do MMA events. I'm also a promoter in Milwaukee. So just keeping busy training and doing everything else that involves MMA around here.
I remember last time we talked about the business side with the gym, but being a promoter, does that make you look at the fight game differently?
Yeah. I mean, I understand the business side of things. You know, a lot of these fighters, you know, him and haw about, you know, the things that they want. But when you're looking at it from both sides, you can kind of see both sides of it, you know? So you kind of understand the business a little bit more, and you learn ways that you can, you know, be more marketable or get your name out there better as a fighter, and what that can do for you as far as, you know, financial gain and stuff like that.
I've talked to a lot of guys, and over the past couple weeks, I've been asking about, you know, if there was a rule you could change in MMA, what it is. And I guess it's kind of unique for you, since you can kind of see it from both sides, a promoter side of things you see what go on in your show, but also as a fighter throughout your fighting career. If you could change any rule in MMA, what would it be?
I really think they're doing a good job with the health and safety of the MMA fighters now. You know, when I first started fighting as an amateur, a lot of states were still unregulated, and now, you know, all states have a sanctioning body, and you know, we all have to get our physical and blood work done and things of that sort. In order to fight in the UFC, I had to get a CT scan done, and I have to go for pretty rigorous and frequent checkups and things like that. So I think they're doing a much better job more than ever before with the health and safety. And that was kind of my main concern when I got into this.
Was that the biggest thing when you got into the UFC of just kind of the major differences is the fact of the amount of medical testing that has to get done to actually get approved for a fight?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, in a lot of states, CT scans are only required, and EKG are only required once you start to reach an older age, like maybe after 40 years old. But because the UFC goes everywhere and all these different sanctioning bodies have their own set of rules, they don't want to be held up when they're trying to matchmake. So we just go ahead and we do all the requirements when you get signed to the UFC. When I first signed, I had like 16 days until I was going to have my UFC debut. And they do a great job of getting everything done very efficiently and quickly. And I was just, the day after I got the phone call, the whole next day I spent at different doctor's office getting all these different exams done and things like that. So they go really above and beyond what anybody else would do to keep, you know, their fighters safe.
And when people look at your record, it is kind of crazy that your three fights in UFC all come by split decision. You know, has your mindset been different after every fight before the judges have read the scorecard?
Yeah. Some fights I was more confident than others, but they all kind of had the same result, you know, on paper. I really don't see on the last one where the split came from. I thought I clearly won the first two rounds. Berkman, you know, all three of the rounds were kind of close. So depending on how you looked at it or how you judged, you know, depending on if you were a person that took damage in more consideration or if you were a person that took more volume in consideration, you know, things like that, how you score a takedown versus a submission attempt, things like that. I could see how a split decision could have occurred, even though every media outlet had me winning the fight against Berkman. Yeah. I could see where a possible split would have come from. As far as the last fight, I was just totally caught off guard. I thought it was going to be clearly 29-28. And when the scorecard started to get read off, that it was, you can tell when it's a split the way it's read. And I was just really crossing my fingers there for a couple of seconds, hoping that I wasn't going to get screwed, but it all worked out and I got the W.
And since that UFC debut, you've become a world traveler with the UFC, Brazil, New Zealand, now in China. So, you know, how do you get your body ready for, A, you've got the long fight, but also kind of, you know, the time change of when you're fighting in comparison to when, say, you would fight here in the United States?
Yeah, there's little tweaks you can do as far as adjusting your sleep schedule. You know, when we went down to Brazil, it wasn't that big of a difference because you're going south. So you're staying relatively in a similar time zone. But when you start to then cross over that international date line and things like that, things start to really get turned upside down. So, you know, switching workout time, switching my sleep schedule a little bit, and just making sure that I'm staying really diligent with my workouts and my diet and everything. And, you know, this is, like you said, the third time in a row that I'm doing this. So you do something enough times, you tend to get used to it. So it's all becoming kind of routine at this point.
Is the diet the hardest part about being a fighter?
Making weight is the hardest part for sure. And, you know, depending on what weight class you fight at, I suppose, and how much weight you decide to cut and things. But it's unfortunate that, you know, the weight classes right at 155 and 170, where probably the most fighters are licensed, right? Out of all professional MMA fighters in the world, probably more people licensed to fight at 155 and 170 than any other weight class. And that's right when the weight classes start to go in 15-pound increments. So those are some big jumps. And if I were to go up to 185, you know, these guys got quite a bit bigger frame than I do. So 170 is something I have to do, and it's not easy for me. So it really helps this time knowing about the fight a lot further out than I did for my last one even. Obviously, when you first get into the UFC, you're probably going to be fighting on a short notice. But I did take the last one even on short notice just because I had been out for a little while with an injury. The opportunity came in. I liked the opportunity, so I took it. But I only had like 3 weeks, maybe a little over 3 weeks to lose 35 pounds. And when you're trying to fight that battle with a scale and you're trying to get ready for a high-level MMA fight, a lot of those workouts, you know, you're running on an empty tank, and it can be hard to get those workouts in and get a good intense workout in. So it's been much easier this time, knowing about the fight well in advance, and my weight's better than it's ever been. And I just feel, you know, really prepared for this one. And I think that weight cut week is going to go as smooth as it's ever been.
And, of course, taking on Jai Ling here, who's been in the UFC, you know, since 2014. He's won 3 in a row. And, you know, I mean, look, the cliche you always hear is, hey, there's a reason I love this fight matchup. I love the style of this fight. So why do you like this matchup for yourself?
I like it because he brings the fight. You know, a lot of the guys that I've been fighting are kind of, they would evade during a combination. This guy stands in the pocket a little bit more. So, there's some things that I can do better, and I think it's going to help with landing the shots that I need to either finish the fight or at least get a convincing decision this time instead of a split. Sometimes when you're fighting runners, it can be a little, frustrating, and you know you're trying to cut off the cage, and the cage is a lot bigger than you think. You know, the UFC octagon is quite a bit bigger than anything on the regional level, and you're trying to, you know, score these combinations. It helps when a person stands in the pocket a little bit more, brings the fight, can be a little bit more exciting, and like I said, the opportunities to land solid shots can be there more readily.
You know, sometimes there's a smaller octagon for the UFC event based on the venue of what can fit. Do you ask anybody in the UFC leading up to the fight of like, hey, do we got the big octagon or the small octagon?
I guess I haven't really thought about that a whole lot because every time I've been to an event, it's always been the big one. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure how often they use the smaller one. I thought they only used that like on the Ultimate Fighter show and things like that.
It's based on the venue, depending on how the venue size. Okay. Like I know, like when they did events at the Palms, they had to use a smaller cage.
Oh sure. Yeah, I guess I never really thought about it as far as the events that I've been fighting at, and I just always assumed that it would be the bigger one. So I've always kind of assume that and just trained accordingly.
Mm-hmm. With this being your fourth fight in the UFC, you know, there may still be some UFC fans that maybe aren't aware of who you are. What would you want those fans to know about you?
You know, on the regional level, I was a finishing machine. You know, I was finishing everybody first or second round. And I'd like to get back to that. I just think that, you know, the caliber of fighters that I've been fighting have been higher up there. You know, Josh Berkman, obviously still at the time, a very legend of the sport, pioneer, bringing up, the welterweight division from a long time ago, winning record in the UFC and, world champion in another organization. And then after that, I had an undefeated, fighter that I, you know, world champion jiu-jitsu, I think he was like 4-0 in the welterweight division when I fought him. The last guy was 3-1 in the division. This guy's, my next guy's 5-2 in the division. Like, I'm not getting anybody that's on the way out where when I beat them, they're going to get cut or, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I'm fighting all mid to higher tier UFC fighters. So it's a little bit harder to get the finishes over these guys when I'm just first starting to get into the UFC and get my feet under me. You know what I mean? So yeah. I think the time that I've had in the cage so far, I've had 45 minutes in the UFC octagon, you know, logged in. I think that's all really going to pay dividends going in the future now against these next opponents. And I can really start to get back to my finishing ways against this level of fighters.
As always, I appreciate Zach Otto coming on the podcast, talk about his upcoming fight. I had a chance to now interview Zach a couple of times. Good luck to him coming up next week at UFC Fight Night 122. But, of course, coming up on Thursday of this week, it is Bellator 187. Initially, was going to have Patricio Pitbull and Daniel Vichel on this podcast. Actually did record interviews with both those fighters, but, of course, that fight is now off Thursday's Bellator 187. But I did have a chance to catch up with John Salter, talk to him about his matchup, a part of this fight card, which for John Salter, a win for him could really clinch that title matchup that he has been looking for. John, I appreciate time as always. How's things been, man?
It's going really well. Just up my training camp right now.
And of course, this training camp, you've had to go through an opponent change here. You know, first off, how did that alter the way you prepared for this fight?
I had to change a little. I was fighting a shorter opponent with a little less reach than me, and then that's more of a boxer style fighter. You know, now I go to an opponent with a little longer reach than me. That's a more of a Muay Thai guy. So I had to, you know, make some small changes there. Do a little traveling to get some different opponents or different sparring partners just to get that feel. But, you know, all in all, it's about getting in shape and being sharp and getting my timing down. So it doesn't change things too terribly much.
When you get the phone call that, you know, Toe Call was out of the fight, disappointing? Is that about the best way to describe it?
In a way, yeah. I mean, obviously that's a tough fight that's going to move me in the right direction. But at the end of the day, you got to kind of start your training camp knowing that's a possibility, I think, because it is hard to get to a training camp without getting injured. There's a lot of, you know, people hitting you, kicking you, trying to take you down, and that kind of stuff's going to happen. So every fight camp I start with the mindset of that could eventually happen. And so that way I'm always kind of prepared for that possibility.
You've been on a great run since coming into Bellator, and when you initially heard that Alessio Sicara is getting the next title fight, where he had been fighting at 205 and is coming back down to 185, what was your mindset? Where you kind of did all get that, you know, have the conversation with Rich and say, "Hey, man, what do I got to do to get a title shot?"
Yeah, I was a little pissed at first. I found out the day of weigh-ins for the Kendall Grove fight, so you know I was a little pissed because I was under the assumption that, you know, from what I was being told, that I got to beat Kendall Grove and then I'm going to get a title shot after that. So when, you know, when it came up that Sicara was getting it, it definitely pissed me off, but I have no control over it. It's all politics. So, you know, at the end of the day, I just got to let it roll off my back and prepare for the next fight.
And the opponent here, Jason Radcliffe, you know, people will naturally say, oh, this guy comes in here and he's lost back-to-back fights. But, you know, both the opponents he lost to both have quality records. One of those opponents is now in the UFC. What do you see as the biggest challenge that he's going to offer you in this fight?
He's got a lot of power. You know, he's got a lot of first-round wins. He's definitely an explosive athletic guy that's got good, solid Muay Thai. So, you know, I've got to stay away from his power. I got to work in and out. I think, you know, looking at a couple of his fights, he showed that if I can hit him on the chin, you know, he has had problems getting knocked out. But, you know, you got to definitely forget about those last two fights because, you know, those guys aren't me and they're not going to fight in the exact same way I do. So that doesn't really matter.
when you're in a fight, is it more about read and reacting as opposed to what your game plan is, or is it a mixture between the two?
It's a mixture between the two. You know, I've got a game plan when I go into a fight. I've got, you know, you got your plan A and your plan B, you know, if you can't make one of them happen. And then, you know, obviously you got to do a lot of reacting off what they do. You know, if they give – a lot of times I go into a fight with a plan of something I'm going to do in the second round, and they might offer that up in the first round, and I've just got to take it then.
And, of course, you haven't wasted any time. I mean, is it just one of those things that it's just – it's an instinct thing of knowing, like, man, I got to go for it here, because you never know if that opportunity may be there in the second or third round.
Yeah, that's one of those things that when you see something, you got to attack it. And one thing I've really tried to do in my career, I've made some mistakes early in my career of not doing this, but not necessarily just looking to finish all the time. Kind of looking to chip away at them, beat on them, do damage. And as soon as an opportunity presents itself, you know, taking advantage right away rather than trying to make opportunities that may not be there.
You've been in this game for a long time, pro debut back in 2009. What's the biggest difference in the way you look at the fight game now as opposed to back in 2009?
I look at it as back then it was basically, I better take somebody down or I'm in trouble. And, you know, now I'm not in a rush to get a takedown, move around, throw my hands. You know, if it goes to the ground, great. If it doesn't, you know, I'm comfortable there now.
How, you know, you mentioned about, you know, early on you knew you had to get the fight to the ground. How long did it take for that confidence level to know, like, look, I don't have to get the fight to the ground? Did it take a long time for that to happen?
You know, my second pro fight, I fought Roberto Traven, who he'd been in the UFC, but he's also a two-time ADCC champ, you know, one of the best white belts in the world. So I was a purple belt at the time. So that was one of those, a situation of, okay, I really don't need to just plan on being on the ground with this guy. And I came in and knocked him out in about 2.5 minutes. I knocked him down once, and I made him get back up. And that gave me confidence that I've got the power in my hands that I need to hurt somebody. Then I just had to get the confidence, start slipping punches, and make people miss.
You mentioned a little earlier, because of the opponent change, that you had to, you know, get some new training partners at various gyms. So where have you been training for this fight?
Well, I did most of my whole camp here in North Carolina. I've gone down a couple times to South Carolina just to get some different training partners. But, you know, after Derek Brunson just came off a big win, so since he's been back, he's kind of the perfect training partner for this guy. Real similar build. And, so, you know, been sticking with him a lot since he's been back from the fight.
Is a little bit of a friendly rivalry, like you feel like you got to one-up what Derek just did?
You know, it'd be great, but I think Derek and I are definitely each other's biggest fans, because the better I do, the better he does, and vice versa. You know, we push each other all the time, and it grows our group of training partners here when we do well. But we're definitely, neither one of us like to miss an opportunity to finish the fight, that's for sure.
Going overseas, over to Israel to fight, what's the biggest challenge in going over there? Is it just basically, you know, the flight over and the weight cut? Is that kind of the biggest challenge?
You know, I do a pretty good job with my weight now. Had issues in the past of having hard weight cuts, but I really don't anymore. I'd say the biggest issue is just not getting tight on the plane ride. You know, I mean, I think it's a 10-hour plane ride at one point. So, you know, staying loose through that, you know, that's a big thing. Other than that, I don't really think it affects a whole lot.
And so on a 10-hour flight, I mean, are you just kind of, are you loading up on movies? You know, loading up on Netflix? How do you plan on kind of buying that time?
Definitely going to be doing a lot of watching movies and, see how much sleeping I can do. I try to get up and stretch a lot, but I just came back from Finland not too long ago from competing in the ADCC World Championships that I qualified for. So, you know, I kind of got, I'm used to that flight and moving around, you know. But like I said, I mean, I try to get up, stretch some, and then just watch as many movies as I can.
How'd you fare in the tournament?
Oh, I did not do so hot. I had a really good tournament to qualify, be two world champs, to qualify, and then I got out there and just had a bad game plan going out and ended up getting submitted.
And there you have my conversation with John Salto. Really appreciate him coming on the podcast, talking about his fight coming up on Thursday of this week at Bellator 187. And you have to imagine, if John Salto gets a win, he's got to be next up for a title fight in Bellator's middleweight division. Of course, as I mentioned prior to the interview, had recorded interviews with Patricio Pitbull and Daniel Vaitchell. Of course, Patricio had to pull out this fight card due to an injury, and clearly that's a matchup that, you know, I want to see how the rematch goes after seeing how the first fight went. So I'll be putting some stuff out on my YouTube channel of my conversations with Patricio Pitbull and Daniel Vaitchell. So definitely you want to be subscribing to my YouTube channel. Just search The MMA Report. Put a ton of content up there. Also, this week on the MMA Report's YouTube channel, going to have a conversation with Tim Caron, who fights this weekend. So be on the lookout for that, fighting at Combat Zone. Also, already up on the YouTube channel is an interview I did with Jeremy Davis, who's coming off a win last weekend at V3 Fights, where had a little bit of his opponent had a wardrobe malfunction, and you can hear exactly what happened with that. But right now, I'm going to get to my final interview here on this week's podcast, and it is with the LFA lightweight champion, Robert Whatley. We had him on the podcast last week and caught up with him this week to talk about his win in retaining the LFA lightweight title. All right, I am now joined by the reigning and defending LFA lightweight champion, Robert Whatley, who, of course, made that successful title defense this past Friday night at LFA 27. You know, the old cliche, Rob, you hear is you're not the champion until you make that title defense, and you mentioned that after the fight. You know, how was this fight different as opposed to, you know, when you won the title the first time?
Well, I guess the main difference for me was the fact that in the Moises fight, nobody thought I was going to win that fight at all. And I going into this one, I was actually a pretty good size favorite. So I was really expected to win this one. So in those regards, that was probably the biggest difference, was like, okay, I'm expected to go out there as the champion. I'm expected to go make a dominant defense of my title. So it was like we talk about pressure and how you deal with it. So it was a good pressure, and I was able to Lord saw willing to, you know, let me use that pressure to help me perform well in that cage.
Fight starts out, you land a right hand, and you immediately try to get this fight to the ground. Was that basically the part of the game plan where you just kind of felt that a big advantage for you in this fight would be in the clinch and getting the fight to the ground?
You know, I wanted to kind of strike with him, because I have this thing where, like, if somebody's good at something, that I've got to just test myself in that, I guess his level of expertise or his area of expertise, and it drives my coaches crazy. So for this one, I tried to fight a little more smart, and I, from watching him, because as soon as I get an opponent, I watch everything that I can find on him. I'll look him up. I'll try and, like, know them personally before I get in the cage. So, I'd watched a couple of his fights, and it looked like he didn't do too well with offensive wrestling. And I figured if I could mix in my strikes as well with some level changes, I could be pretty successful with that. And, you know, after the first round, I think I had like two or three takedowns. I was like, okay, well, I think I've got the blueprint for how to, you know, come out victorious on this one.
You talk about, you know, putting pressure on your opponent, you know, and did you kind of feel like, hey, I've got to put pressure on, because I feel he doesn't react well when his opponent is putting that pressure on him?
Yes. And also, I'm learning myself. I'm still pretty wary of, letting my hands go, and like striking. It's a little more unnerving to me, as compared to like being attached to someone and grappling with them. So, I realized that if I'm always initiating, if I'm always going first, I don't have to worry so much about what the person's going to do. So I think, yeah, the pressure helped me actually, being able to pressure him actually helped relax me quite a bit for this fight. So I remember I was like throwing strikes and I was landing them, and I was like, man, like I'm not even trying right now. And that, like, I'm just getting warmed up, man. So, you know, I'm still growing as a martial artist. I'm still still learning so many things, but you know, I'm still, you know, getting better. So it was a pretty exciting fight.
Into the second round, you know, when you lose the contact, what is going through your mind?
Well, I've already told you what my nickname is, right? Like the unofficial. Yeah, contact. So, I mean, it's like at this point, like I expect to, I put my contacts in my coach's bucket and I'm just like, just if I lose them in between rounds, we'll try and put them in. That's what I was trying to do. But after a while, I was like, you know what? I fought almost as many rounds without my contacts as I have with them. So it wasn't going to deter me. And especially because I knew I was going to use a grapple heavy game plan. So, you know, you don't need your eyes a ton when you're like face to face with a guy.
And of course it was in the third round that you got the stoppage there. Was there ever a moment where you kind of had that mindset of like, hey man, is this referee going to come in and stop this? Because, you know, clearly, I mean, you were dominating.
I was watching, we were in his corner for a lot of the fight and I was like looking at how they were reacting. And at first they were doing a really good job of giving him advice, but I just kept shutting everything down. And like, I kind of see that his corner was like, all right, like we probably might want to get our boy out of there in a little bit. And so I realized I need to turn it up even more. Cause I mean, if you're in a bad spot and your corner is just like, well, shit, I don't know what to do. Like the fight's probably pretty close to getting stopped. So I'm just learning to be more aware in there and know everything that's going on. I'm hearing my corners. I'm doing, you know, pretty much everything it is that they say almost immediately after they say it. And I'm aware of where I am in the cage. So it's all coming together really nicely. I still have so much I want to like show the world that I'm capable of in this sport. But I'm just, you know, happy with where I am and I'm going to be patient and take my time, try to be the best mixed martial artist that I can be.
I know you have probably gone back and watched the fight multiple times, and you're obviously pointing out the negatives as opposed to the positives. But from the positive aspect, what are you most impressed with about your own performance?
I would say probably my transitions. I think a lot of people, I think there's people that are better than me, but they're at like the highest level of the sport, and that's what it's going to take. It's everybody's going to be good at striking in the top five. Everybody's going to be, you know, somewhat good at grappling. They're going to be really well-rounded, but the thing that is going to separate people is your ability to transition between striking to grappling to, you know, takedowns. And I think that is the one thing in my game that's like kind of setting me apart at this point, is because Daryl, every time I would let him think we were exchanging, and then as soon as he got comfortable standing, I shot on him because I realized he wasn't prepared for that. So I'm learning, still getting awareness. I'm still a baby in the game, man. Still have another fight on my contract for LFA. And you know, I'm a professional. It would be easy to, you know, opt out and take a short notice UFC fight or a Bellator fight, but you know, I'm not here for like some early payout. Like I want to finish up my contract and, you know, see what my options are as a free agent moving forward and seeing, you know, I want to be taken seriously, as a fighter, as a man. And I realized that I need to fulfill my contract obligations and then really start to, look at what the possibilities are for me moving forward.
That's interesting what you said there, because I would have to imagine a lot of guys, if they were in your position and, you know, they've got one fight left on their deal, they sit there and say, you know what, hey, UFC comes calling or Bellator comes calling, I'm going to take that opportunity. You know, why do you think it is that maybe your thought process is different than other guys?
Well, of course it's, you know, my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, he's given me a vision, you know, kind of for how I believe I can affect the landscape of MMA. And I realize I can't expect to make any change. I can't expect to, stand out if I do the same thing as everybody else. I can't, you know, won't call it selling out, but like if I realize I'm still a developing product, if I realize that I still have things that I could learn, things that I could be implementing during a fight, it would be foolish on me to just say, yeah, you know what, I want the money. Like I'll you know, take my time. I'll fight for probably less than I'm worth right now, but I'll also gain a lot of experience and I'll be well polished by the time that I get to, you know, the bigger league. So, and I'm just appreciative of the opportunity. I get to fight on live TV. get to travel to, you know, places I've never been before. So, I mean, it's just a blessing, man.
Hey, have you put the little nudge in Ed Soares' ear? Like, you know, hey, I'm an East Coast guy. You know, LFA needs to come to the East Coast. Let me have a hometown fight.
You hit the nail on the head. Yeah, we've actually been in contact trying to figure out where in the DMV area, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, that we could put on this show. Because now that I went fought for it in North Carolina, got it there. Then I went to the Challenger's backyard and beat him there. So now, yeah, we're definitely talking about let's bring some people, let's bring some eyes to the DMV. There's so many talented guys out here, but they just need like a foot in the door. And I realize I can, you know, possibly be that foot in the door. So just trying to use this position to try and help as many people as I possibly can.
And in your post-fight interview, one of the things you did mention, hey, credited the guys around you that have, you know, put you in this position, have helped you, you know, guide you along the career. Was there any message they had for you after the fight was over?
They basically just kind of said that it was a pleasure to work with me, like from, you know, getting up in the morning to going and grabbing brunch to like, I was just having so much fun that night. Like I was running around. I was like, before the fight started, I was like taking pictures of people and just shaking hands. And I was just like, man, how cool is this? Like people are like, oh, that's the dude in the main event. And I'm like, yeah, it's me.
Are you always that loose before a fight?
I'm getting there. I freaks all my teammates out. I can sleep before the fights. So everybody will be warming up back there and I'll be like knocked out. I'd be like, just let me know. And it's like 20 minutes before my fight. So, yeah, man, I'm learning in order to, there's an anxiety about fighting. And I think everybody's like, I just want to get it over. I want to get it over. And then when you start worrying about getting it over and stop enjoying the moment, you lose, not necessarily lose the fight, but you lose bits and pieces of like an intimate experience that they should change you. You know, this, you're going to unarmed combat with another human being. So it's, I love it. It's terrifying. It's the craziest thing that I could ever, have found in my life. And I know that's, you know, the Lord brought me to this and, you know, look where we are here, you know, now, man, like we're sitting here having this conversation. Like I said, you were one of the few people to even interview me before my fight. And I mean, now we're sitting here talking about, you know, my first title defense of my world title. So, man, God's good and anything can happen, dude.
And now you get to enjoy the holidays with no fight camp, which I know for fighters, that's a big thing. You hate being around the holidays and, you know, you can't enjoy the festivities with your family. And I was talking to another fighter actually, just fought this past Saturday, and he was telling me, he's like, yeah, man, can't wait for mom's cooking on Thanksgiving. He told me his thing was his mom makes spicy baked beans that he absolutely loves. Is there a go-to item for you on Thanksgiving?
Oh, it's mac and cheese, of course.
Now, are we talking like regular mac and cheese? Like, is there a special version that gets cooked?
Yeah, it's definitely grandma's version, and I don't know what it is. I'll probably never know. It's a family secret that she's going to take with her, but, I mean, it's slamming, man. Homemade.
But, you know, once the holidays gets over, I mean, I know you're probably already back in the gym, getting your workouts in. I mean, you know, is there a timetable for when you would prefer to have your next fight?
I would say probably like January. I'd like to get back in there. Don't want to wait too long. I didn't get injured in my last fight. Like you said, I've been back in the gym and, just ready to like grow. It was funny. I got like a huge, like resurgence in like my desire and my will to be at the gym and to train and to like learn, in that fight, I would look so dominant, and perform so well. But there was still bits of me being like, oh, I could be so much better. I could have done so much better. So it was a very eye-opening experience all the way around, and it made me realize I got to really focus in here. These are there's a small window, and you know the end of the window doesn't ever end, and I'm coming, you know, up on that time. So I want to be able to look back on this and say that I gave it everything I have. Like, let's start today, not tomorrow.
The resurgence. When did this happen?
I don't know. I guess there was like maybe a sense of monotony a little bit, which I think everybody has with everything they do, because, you know, within what your job context is, you're going to do pretty much the same thing every day. But I guess Me picking up striking. I'm teaching striking at my gym now. Okay. And like really hearing people like seeing mostly like kids come up to me and they're like Mr. Watley, like you look so great, this and that, and you know, oh my gosh, I one day I want to be like you. And I'm like, man, like what a responsibility, what like a an honor. So yeah, it humbles me. It's like here's these kids, here's even these grown people who are like, I could never even dream of what the things that you do in a cage. And that's like, okay, like a lot of people are behind me. There's a lot of hope and a lot of people, especially in the Southern Maryland area, who are just like, just please, one for us, just one for us. So I'm feeling it. I'm carrying them on my shoulders, but at the same time, like they're carrying me. So, man, I'm just blessed to be here doing this interview, and like you said, about to get to eat some good food over the holidays, and then hopefully get back and make a defense. I want to fight. I don't know if you checked out that card. Alex Hernandez, mm-hmm. He was like the fight or two before my, he was a fight, two fights before me. He's like 8-1. I think he's won his last like 5 or 6, but, on the fight card, if you go back and watch the commentary, they were watching him fight and they were talking about how, I guess Ron Kruk was talking about how this is the future of martial arts. I was like, oh, well, that's a little bit of a burn. So I feel like there's still unfinished business left with LFA, and I think that I need to start being assertive and let them know who it is I want to fight. And I know that's a fight that everybody wants to see happen. He's a dangerous guy, but I believe I can rise to the occasion and beat him. So that's what I want. Hopefully January timeframe. They were talking about, he's a Texas guy, would you go down to Texas? I was like, I'm not fighting in anybody else's backyard. People can come to my house.
Would there be a dream venue for you to make your next title defense in?
Well, this is like huge hopes, but I know it won't happen. But like, they just opened to MGM down here in Oxon Hill, Maryland.
Okay.
And I mean, that I would love to fight in MGM in literally my home state. Like I think I fought in Baltimore, but it's been quite some time since I did my Shogun fight. So being able to fight in front of like everybody and just seeing how excited the community is, man, it's, if that happens, like, oh, God help Alex.
But of course, congratulations on the victory. I really appreciate you coming on the show. As always, man, let everyone know they can follow you out on the various social media platforms.
You can follow me on Twitter at RobertWiley89, and you can follow me on Instagram at RobertWiley.
And there you have my conversation with Robert Watley. I really appreciate him coming on the podcast, talking about his victory this past Friday night at LFA 27 to retain the LFA lightweight title. Now, I do want to get into some questions and comments that were submitted on the MMAreport.com. They are all these are from hardcore MMA fans. Just kind of quickly go through some of these here that he did post. He says, how many former UFC fighters that are now in Bellator are in the UFC video games? I'll be honest, I don't know the exact answer to that. The person that would be best suited to submit that question to would actually be Mike Baum of MMAJunkie.com. I'll be honest with you, don't really pay attention to the UFC video game, so I really can't give you an answer on how many former UFC fighters that are now in Bellator are in the UFC video game. Next up, you did ask about Lorenz Larkin, Fernando Gonzalez, which I mentioned earlier on the podcast, being a catchweight at 180 pounds, was asking why is this. I do not know the answer to that question currently. I'm going to reach out to both fighters and maybe see exactly why this is a catchweight. I mean, one thing that should be noted is that, you know, last two fights for Fernando Gonzalez have been catchweight matchups, so maybe are his days at 170 pounds over there or not. Until I talked about fighters, it's really tough for me to kind of answer that question at this point. Also, he hardcore MMA fans ago said, how many top 10 free agents will sign with Bellator next year, do you think? You know, looking at, you know, just to kind of the UFC rankings and kind of going down the top 10. I mean, I can't sit here. I don't know the exact contract situation of all those fighters. You know, look, I think Bellator will make runs at those fighters. But I think, you know, when you talk about free agency, and this is the thing you have to always remember, if the UFC wants to keep you, they will keep you. If they feel that, you know what, hey, I've always said this, I think the UFC is trying to bankrupt Bellator. That's just my honest opinion about it. And that's why I think you're letting some of these guys walk away for the amount of money that Bellator is giving them. And, you know, you've seen, you know, at the end of the day, you know, when Bellator pays these big salaries, those fighters got to bring in those big ratings. And, you know, the television ratings have not necessarily been a home run for Bellator since that pay-per-view. Also, you asked about UFC 217 being the greatest of all time pay-per-view. What are your top five UFC pay-per-views of all time? Look, UFC 217 was a great pay-per-view. You know, I think that it's, you know, it's very subjective in terms of pay-per-views, but I'll be honest, honestly, I really never sat there and thought about pay-per-views. I mean, I've probably, you know, how many, you know, hundreds of pay-per-views have I watched? You know, you look at 217, you definitely, it's definitely going to be up there. But I think in terms of, you know, we live in the moment of these pay-per-views. Let's let some time kind of pass on before we start kind of grading those out. Asked about what are your top 10 MMA GOATs? First off, there can't be 10 greatest of all time. There can only be one greatest of all time. And to me, it's George St. Pierre. Top five MMA Mount Rushmore. You know, when you talk about Mount Rushmore, to me, that you're talking about guys who you can't write the, or fighters, that you cannot write the history of MMA without mentioning them. And look, it's tough to only say five. You know, when I talk about, you know, writing the history of MMA, you know, look, if you want to go old school, Royce Gracie, you want to go newer school, GSP, Anderson Silva. You know, look, you can't write the history of MMA without the name Lorenzo Fertitta. You know, so, I mean, you know, to me, when I start thinking about Rushmore, those are some of the names that kind of come to my mind. But that's the way I view Mount Rushmore is you're writing a history of something. And to me, you know, those are some of the fighters. I mean, look, you got to mention Ronda Rousey, because you can't write the history of women's MMA without mentioning Ronda Rousey. Also, a hardcore MMA fan that mentioned something about John Jones, and I quickly want to mention this, and I'll wrap it up here. It says John Jones is going to get a free pass because UFC needs him and is protecting him. Here's the thing. The UFC cannot protect John Jones from a failed drug test. Now, since it was an in-competition drug test, that'll be the jurisdiction relies with the California State Athletic Commission. Obviously, USADA will have their part, but it'll be next month in L.A. where John Jones will have or is scheduled to have that hearing with the California State Athletic Commission. And look, I expect John Jones to get a 2-year suspension. So I do appreciate the questions and comments that were submitted, whether it was on social media earlier on the show or here at the end of the show on the MMAreport.com. So I want to thank all my guests for coming on the show. Of course, at the beginning, we had Daniel Galvan to recap the craziness of last weekend. Then we talked to UFC fighters Frank Camacho and Zach Otto. Then we talked to Bellator fighter John Salter. And of course, the last interview with Robert Whatley. All those interviews will be available on the MMAreport.com YouTube channel as well. The interviews with Frank Camacho and Robert Whatley were done in video, so you'll be able to check those out if you want to see it in video form. So, of course, I do appreciate everyone listening to this podcast. If you are not subscribing, please subscribe to this podcast. Really would appreciate rate and review, and let all your friends know about this podcast. Really appreciate everyone that listens every week here on the MMA Report. Of course, on Friday, I will have a preview podcast for UFC Fight Night 121. So that's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the MMA Report podcast. You're here every Wednesday on RadioInfluence.com.
This is a Sitting Ringside with David Penzer. Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
I'm assuming that you watched it, and I'm wondering what you thought, because as somebody who's been a longtime fan and a huge Ric Flair fan, I'm wondering what you thought, because I lived it. I mean, there's nothing that was in there that surprised me. It surprised me that certain people said it out loud and that they aired it, but nothing in there that surprised me as far as that goes. So I'm wondering, as a fan, what were your thoughts?
I love the candidness that that Rick spoke with. You know, I loved obviously hearing, and I have obviously known his career for a long time as far as, you know, where he had gone, the promotions, the territories. But I think the part that at least hit with me really hard was the personal life. You know, to hear his kids talk on camera, for him to openly admit, you know, he just wasn't home all the time. And You know that happens with wrestlers a lot. You know, they talk about being on the road 300 days a year, and they're just not around. It's just the nature of the line of work they're in. But to hear his kids speak and to hear about, you know, he was bored being home. He would head over to another wrestler's house to hang out for a while. But just to hear the family side of it, to hear the humanistic side of it, and to finally hear that the Ric Flair persona, it really became too much for him to walk away from. I mean, you know, the family life in some ways wasn't for him in the early going. So I love the human interest side of it. But Rick's a candid guy. I mean, you know him probably just as well as anybody. But I loved it. I loved it. I don't know if I could necessarily pick out one aspect that I liked the best about it. But I think overall it was such a well done piece. And I think it was really neat that they did 2-part interview with him, meaning interview him in a one time. And then 16 months later, they went ahead and they did a second interview with him. So I loved it. I have nothing to bark about. And all the emotion was in there. Did you feel that as well, that it wasn't just a story, but it was this person's life that they had lived, and all these people around them were there because they had shared moments with him?
Yeah, I mean, Rick's an emotional guy. We all know that. And, you know, Rick is far from perfect, as he said himself. And that's the part that I wonder as a fan. Of course, with social media and the internet, you know, fans know way more now than they did back, you know, in the 80s and 90s. But I'm wondering, as a fan, you know, somebody who walked down the aisle of their wedding wanting to wear a Ric Flair robe with belts, and we're not going to relive that. But I'm just trying to point out that that's how much of a fan you were. I'm wondering if it disappointed you that he's a real person with some real big flaws.
I mean, I think when you look at that side of it, you know, going into it, that you're right. No one's perfect. And that he can admit to that as well. Were there some aspects that I kind of was like, I don't know if I necessarily align myself with as far as family values and whatnot? Yeah, of course. Absolutely. When it came to the topic of monogamy, you know, I kind of cringed a little bit. But once again, he lives his life the way he does. I live the life the way I do. Just because you don't see eye to eye on every necessarily moral stance, it doesn't mean that you can't still respect people. As far as I'm concerned, I don't see anybody that Rick has gone out of his way to hurt, if that makes sense. I know things might not have always worked out relationship-wise, but it never feels like people are outwardly angry towards him. Does that make sense? I really feel like everybody, kind of for the most part, is just, that's Rick.
I think that they did for a long time. I think as he got into his 60s and got older, and he still continued with the shenanigans, I think that a lot of people, I know that a lot of people started rolling their eyes. There's, you know, there's a time in someone's life where they have to sort of be, you know, stop being a character and you know, move to the next phase of your life. And I think until he almost died, quite frankly, I don't think he was able to do that.
Sitting Ringside with David Penzer can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.